This is Audible.
Men of Athens, I don't know how you felt as you listened to my accusers, but they spoke so persuasively that they almost made me forget who I am. But not much of what they said is true. Among their many lies, one especially amazed me. I mean, when they told you to be on your guard so that you are not deceived by the power of my eloquence, that they were not ashamed of saying this seemed to me most shameless of them, since they were sure to be refuted as soon as I opened my mouth and displayed my lack of eloquence. Unless by eloquence they mean the power of speaking the truth. If that is what they mean, then I admit I'm an eloquent speaker. My way differs from theirs because, as I just said, they hardly spoke a word that's true. You'll hear the whole truth from me, but not delivered in their way, not in an oration nicely decorated with prepared words and phrases. On the contrary, I'll use the words and arguments that occur to me at the moment. At my age, Athenians, it's not right for me to appear before you in the guise of a youthful orator. Nobody should expect me to do that. And I ask that you grant me one favor. If you hear me using the same words in my defense that you've heard me use in the Agora, at the money changers' tables, or anywhere else, I ask you not to be surprised at this and that you not interrupt me. I'm more than 70 years old, and this is the first time I've ever appeared in a law court. I'm a stranger to the ways of this place. Therefore, please treat me as you would a foreigner. Someone you would excuse for speaking with an accent and in my own dialect. I don't think that's an unfair request. Please ignore my way of speaking, whatever its value, and think only of the justice of my cause. Pay attention to that. Let the just decide fairly, and the speaker speak truly. First, I have to reply to some older charges, to those who first accused me, and then I'll respond to the more recent ones. Many people have accused me, some of them a long time ago, and their false charges have continued over the years. I fear them more than Anytus and his associates, though they, too, are dangerous in their own way. But those who began when you were children, filling your minds with lies, are far more dangerous. They tell stories about a man named Socrates, a wise man who speculates about the heavens above and inquires about the earth below. He makes the worst cause appear to be the better one. Oh, I dread these accusers because when they circulate this rumor, those who hear them are likely to suppose that people who inquire don't believe in the gods. The many charges against me go back to the time when you were young and impressionable. The case was lost by default because nobody was around to defend me. Worst of all, I can't even tell you their names, with the possible exception of a comic poet. The majority of these people have approached you out of envy and spite. Some of them have been persuaded, and then persuaded others. It's extremely difficult to deal with all of them because I can't bring them here and examine them. All I can do to defend myself is fight with shadows and ask questions with nobody to answer them. So, let's assume that my opponents are of two kinds. One recent and the other ancient. I hope you understand why it's appropriate for me to answer the ancient ones first. You have heard these accusations earlier and much more often than the others. Now, I'll defend myself, and in the little time I have, try to dispel the bad opinion of me you have held for so long. And if it's best for both you and me, I hope I'll succeed, and that my words will persuade you. I know that won't be easy, and I have no illusions about the nature of the task. Let things happen according to divine will. I make my defense in obedience to the law. I'll begin at the beginning and consider the accusation that led to the lies that encouraged Miletus to bring charges against me. What do the slanderers say? Let them be my prosecutors. I'll summarize their position in the indictment. Socrates is dangerous because of his excessive curiosity. He investigates things under the earth and in the heavens. He makes the worse appear to be the better cause, and he teaches these things to others. That's the nature of the accusation. And it's what you saw for yourself in the comedy by Aristophanes. He introduced a man whom he calls Socrates, who goes around saying that he can walk on air and who spouts a lot of nonsense about things that I don't pretend to know at all. I don't mean to speak against anyone who studies such things and is wise about them. I'd regret having Miletus add that to the charges against me. Men of Athens, the simple truth is that I have nothing to do with these studies. Many of you who are present can attest to this. I appeal to you. Those of you who have heard me speak, please tell your neighbors whether I have ever lectured, even briefly, on matters of this sort. You'll hear their answer. From their response, you can infer the truth of the rest of what they say about me. Nor are the stories true that I'm a teacher or that I get paid for teaching. But I do respect anyone who is really able to teach. Gorgias of Leontini, Prodicus of Chaos, and Hippias of Elis travel round to cities and are able to persuade young men to join them and ignore their fellow citizens who would teach them for nothing. Not only do they pay them, they thank them for the privilege. I've even heard that there is a sophist from Paros who currently lives in Athens. I learned about him when I met a man named Callias, the son of Hipponicus, who has spent a fortune on sophists. I asked him the following question. Callias, I said, if your two sons were colts or calves, you would have no problem finding someone to look after them. You would hire a horse trainer or a farmer to develop and perfect their natural qualities. But they are human beings. Whom will you select to educate them? Is there anyone who understands the proper qualities for human beings and for citizens? You must have thought about this because you have sons. Is there any such teacher? Oh, there it is, he said. I asked, who is he? Where does he come from and what does he charge? He replied, Evenus from Paros. He charges 5 minae. I said to myself, Evenus is a happy man if he really has this art and charges so little for teaching it. If I had such knowledge, I would be proud and conceited. Athenians, the truth is that I have no such knowledge. I suppose someone will ask, why is this, Socrates? What's the source of these accusations? You must have been doing something strange to gain such notoriety. Such talk about you would never have occurred if you were a normal person. So tell us why this is. We don't want to judge you unjustly. That's a fair request. So I'll try to explain why I've acquired such a bad reputation. Please listen carefully. Some of you may think that I'm joking, but I swear I'm telling the truth. Men of Athens, my reputation comes from a certain kind of wisdom. What kind of wisdom? The kind that human beings can acquire. And it's possible that I am wise in that way. The men I was just talking about evidently have a superhuman wisdom, which I can't describe because I don't have it. Anyone who attributes such wisdom to me is lying in order to slander me. Men of Athens, I beg you not to interrupt me, even if I seem to be bragging. What I'm about to say doesn't come from me, but from a witness who is worthy of respect, one who will tell you about my wisdom, whether I have any and what kind it is. That witness is the god at Delphi. I think you know Chaerephon. He was an old friend of mine and also a friend of yours. He went into exile with you and returned with you when democracy was restored. As you know, Chaerephon was audacious in everything he did. One day he went to Delphi and boldly asked the oracle to tell him whether... Please don't interrupt me! He asked the oracle to tell him whether there is anyone wiser than Socrates. The Pythian prophetess answered that no human is wiser. Chaerephon himself is dead, but his brother is here in court. He'll confirm this story. Why do I tell such a story? Because I'm trying to explain why I have such a bad reputation. When I heard this answer, I asked myself, what can the god mean? How should we interpret this riddle? I don't think that I'm wise, so what can he mean when he says that I'm the wisest? But he is a god, and it's against his nature to lie. I thought about this a long time. Eventually, I came up with a way to investigate his claim. I realized that if I could find someone wiser than myself, I could show that person to the god and refute him that way. I would say, you claim that I'm the wisest, but here's a person who is wiser than I am. So I selected someone with a reputation for wisdom, a politician. I won't mention his name. Here's what happened. When I questioned him, I found out that he wasn't really wise, but many people, especially himself, considered him to be wise. So I tried to explain to him that even though he thought himself to be wise, he really was not. The result was that he hated me, a feeling shared by several who were present and heard our conversation. As I went away, I said to myself, well, I don't suppose that either of us knows anything perfectly beautiful and good, but I'm better off than he is. He knows nothing, but he pretends that he does. I have a slight advantage over him because I don't pretend to know what I don't know. Then I selected another person who had an even greater reputation for wisdom. But the result was the same. I made several more enemies. After that, I went to one person after another, fully conscious of the hatred I aroused. I was sorry about that, and it worried me. But I consider the god's oracle to be of the greatest importance. I investigated its meaning so that the oracle might be proved irrefutable. I told myself that I must serve the god by questioning everyone who pretends to know. I swear to you, Athenians, by the sacred dog of Egypt, that I discovered an amazing correlation. I found that the people with the greatest reputation were generally the most foolish, whereas those thought to be inferior were wiser and better. I'm telling you the tale of my wanderings and of the Herculean labors I endured. What I found out is that the oracle is irrefutable. After the politicians, I went to the poets, tragic, dithyrambic, and various other kinds. I said to myself, now you'll be detected. You'll surely find that you are more ignorant than they are. So I took them some of the most elaborate passages from their own writings. I asked them to tell me what they mean, expecting that they would teach me something. You're not going to believe what happened. I'm almost ashamed to tell you this, but I must. Almost anyone present could have spoken better about their poetry than did the poets themselves. I quickly realized that such poets do not create by wisdom, but by genius and inspiration. These poets are like oracles and prophets who also say many fine things without understanding their meaning. Their method is pretty much the same. I also noticed that because of their poetry, they believed themselves to be wise about other things, but they were not. So I departed, considering myself to be superior to them for the same reason that I was superior to the politicians. Finally, I went to the artisans. I was conscious of my own ignorance, but I was confident that they knew many fine crafts. I wasn't wrong about that. They do know many things I don't know, so in that respect, they are wiser than I am. But I found that even the good artisans make the same mistake as the poets. Because they are good at their art, they think they also know many other important things. This error undermined their wisdom. So, I asked myself on behalf of the oracle whether I would rather be as I am, having neither their knowledge nor their ignorance, or to be like them and have both. I decided that I'm better off as I am. This search made dangerous enemies for me and spawned many lies. I'm called wise because the people who listen to me imagine that I have the wisdom I find lacking in others. Only the god is truly wise. In this oracle, he means to say that human wisdom is worth little or nothing. He's not talking about Socrates, but is only using my name to mean that the person is wisest who, like Socrates, knows that human wisdom is incomplete. So even now I continue to question both citizens and foreigners who appear to be wise. If that person turns out not to be wise, then I make that clear. This service to the god fully occupies me, leaving no time for public affairs or private business. I'm quite poor as a result. One more thing. Young men from the richest families follow me around. They have lots of free time, and they enjoy hearing me question the people who pretend to know. They often imitate me and examine others. They soon find out that there are plenty of people around who believe that they know something, but who really know little or nothing. The result is that the people they question become angry with me rather than being angry with themselves. That terrible Socrates, they say, is a criminal corrupter of young people. But if anyone asks about the evil things he practices or teaches, they can't say because they don't know. To avoid the impression that they have nothing to say, they repeat the ready-made charges used against all philosophers. They teach about things up in the clouds, they have no gods, and they make the worst cause seem to be the better one. They don't like to admit that their pretense to knowledge has been detected, though that's the truth. They are numerous, ambitious, energetic, and come dressed for combat. They have persuasive tongues by which they fill your ears with loud and deep-rooted slander. That is why my three accusers, Miletus, Anytus, and Lycon, have targeted me. Miletus is a quarrel with me on behalf of the poets, Anytus on behalf of the artisans, and Lycon on behalf of the rhetoricians. As I said at the outset, I can't expect to remove this mountain of slander all at once. Men of Athens, this is the truth. I have concealed nothing. I have misrepresented nothing. I know that my straight talk makes them hate me. What is their hatred but proof that I am telling the truth? This is why they slander me, as you will find out in this or any future inquiry. I have said enough about the first group of accusers. Now I turn to the second batch, headed by Miletus, a self-proclaimed good and patriotic man. Before I try to defend myself against them, I must review the charges they bring in their indictment. What do they say? Something like this. Socrates corrupts the young. He does not believe in the gods of the state, and he has created new divinities of his own. That's the sort of charge they bring. Now, let's look at the charges one by one. He says that I corrupt the young. Athenians, I say that Miletus is the guilty one. He is guilty of turning a serious matter into a joke. He puts people on trial out of a pretended zeal and concern about things in which he never had the slightest interest. I'll try to prove what I say is true. Come here, Miletus, so that I can ask you a question. Do you think it's important to improve young people?
Yes, I do.
Then tell the judges who improves them. You must know, since you have taken the trouble to find out who corrupts them and have accused me. Tell us who makes them better. See, Miletus, you are silent and have nothing to say. Isn't that embarrassing, proving what I just said, that you don't really care about the matter? Speak up, friend, and tell us who improves them.
The laws.
That's not what I mean. I want to know who the person is, the one who knows the laws.
The judges, Socrates. The ones present in this court.
What are you saying, Miletus? That they are able to educate and improve the young people?
Of course they are.
All of the judges or only some?
All of them.
By the goddess Hera, that is good news. There are plenty of improvers then. And what about the people watching this trial? Do they improve the young people?
Yes, they do.
What about the senators?
Yes, the senators improve them.
Perhaps the members of the assembly corrupt them, or do they also improve them?
They improve them.
Then every Athenian improves and elevates them, except for me. I alone corrupt them. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying, and that's the truth.
Then I'm extremely unfortunate. But let me ask you another question. Is this also true of horses? Does one person do them harm and the rest of the world benefit them? Or isn't the opposite true? One person benefits them, or only a few people? I mean, the horse trainer benefits them, and most other people tend to injure them. Miletus, isn't that true of horses as well as other animals? Of course it is. It doesn't matter whether you and Anitas admit it or not. Young people would be in great shape if only one person corrupted them and all the rest of the world improved them. You, Miletus, have shown that you never had a thought about young people. Your indifference is clear from your lack of care about what appears in this indictment. Now, Miletus, I must ask another question. Is it better to live among bad citizens or among good ones? Answer, my friend. That's not a hard question. Don't good people benefit their neighbors and bad people do them harm?
Certainly.
Is there anyone who would prefer to be injured rather than be benefited by others? Answer, my good friend. The law requires you to answer. Does anyone like to be injured?
Of course not.
When you accuse me of corrupting and injuring young people, do you claim that I corrupt them intentionally or unintentionally?
Intentionally.
But you just said that good people do good to their neighbors and bad people do them harm. And you think that I don't realize the harm that comes to me from corrupting people with whom I live? It is a truth uncovered by your superior wisdom so early in life, whereas I, at my age, am in such darkness and ignorance. Is that what you're saying, that I intentionally corrupt such people? Well, you'll never convince me of that, nor any other human being. So either I don't corrupt them, or I corrupt them unintentionally. No matter which alternative is true, your indictment is false. If my offense is unintentional, the law will ignore it. In that case, you should have taken me aside and warned me in private. No doubt, had I been better advised, I would have discontinued doing what I did, unintentionally. But you refused to talk with me and teach me. Instead, you indicted me in this court, a place not of instruction but of punishment. Athenians, I have shown that Miletus has no care at all about this matter. But, Miletus, I would still like to know about how you think I corrupt the young. I infer from your indictment that I teach them not to believe in the gods recognized by the state. Rather, I believe in some new divinities or spiritual beings in their place. These, you say, are the lessons that corrupt young people.
Yes, I say that emphatically.
But by the gods of whom we are all speaking, tell me and the court in plain language what you mean. Do you say that I teach others to acknowledge some gods, which means that I do believe in gods and am not an atheist? And do you claim that these are not the same gods that the state recognizes? In that case, the charge is that they are different gods. Or do you mean to say that I am simply an atheist and a teacher of atheism?
I mean the latter, that you are a complete atheist.
That's an extraordinary statement, Miletus. Why do you say such a thing? Do you mean to say that I don't believe in the divinity of the sun and moon as everyone does?
I assure you, judges, that he does not believe in them. He says that the sun is made of stone and the moon of earth.
My friend, you don't seem to realize that you're accusing Anaxagoras, not me. You have a low opinion of the judges if you consider them so ignorant as not to know that these doctrines fill the books of Anaxagoras from Clazomenae. They are the doctrines that young people supposedly learned from Socrates, but for an admission price of no more than one drachma, people can hear them expounded in the theater. They would simply laugh at the absurdity if Socrates pretended to father such ideas. But tell me, Miletus, do you really think that I don't believe in any god?
I swear by Zeus that you believe in absolutely none at all.
You lie, Miletus. You don't even believe it yourself. I can't help thinking, Athenians, that Miletus is reckless and impudent and that he wrote this indictment in a spirit of excess and youthful bravado. He has composed a riddle trying to trick me. He said to himself, let's see whether wise Socrates will discover my ingenious contradiction or whether I can deceive him and everyone else. Miletus contradicts himself. It is as if he said that Socrates is guilty of not believing in gods and at the same time of believing in gods. He's having fun with us. I'd like you, Athenians, to join me in examining this inconsistency. You, Miletus, must answer.
Judges, do
I remind you that you should not interrupt me if I speak in my usual way. Did anyone, Miletus, ever believe in the existence of human actions and not in human beings?
Do we
Men
have-
of Athens, I wish he would answer and not always try to interrupt. Did anyone ever believe in horse training and not in horses, or flute playing and not in flute players? My friend, I'll answer for you to the court, since you refuse to answer for yourself. There's nobody who ever did. Now, please answer the next question. Can anyone believe in spiritual and divine activities and not in spirits or demigods?
They cannot.
I'm glad that I've extracted that answer with the help of the court. However, you swear in the indictment that I teach and believe in divine or spiritual agencies. It doesn't matter whether new or old. But if I believe in divine beings, I must believe in spirits and demigods. Isn't that true? Yes, that's true. I'll assume that your silence means yes. What are spirits or demigods? They are either gods or the children of gods. Isn't that true?
Yes, that's true.
This is the ingenious riddle I was talking about. The demigods or spirits are gods. You say first that I don't believe in gods, and then you say that I do believe in demigods. Therefore, I must believe in gods. If the demigods are the illegitimate children of gods, whether by nymphs or by any other mothers, that necessarily implies the existence of their parents. You might as well affirm the existence of mules and deny the existence of horses and asses. You could only utter such nonsense as a way to test me. You put this into the indictment because you have no serious accusations to make. Nobody who has any sense at all will ever be convinced that the same person can believe in divine activities and yet not believe that there are divinities. I've said enough to answer the charge by Miletus. Any elaborate defense is unnecessary, but as I said before, I have many enemies. You can be sure that if I am destroyed, that's what will destroy me. It will not be Miletus or Anetus, but the envy and slander of the crowd, which has been the death of many good people and will probably be the death of many more. There's no danger of my being the last. Someone might ask, are you not ashamed, Socrates, of living a life that is likely to bring you to an early death? I would answer this way. You are mistaken. A person who is good for anything at all ought not calculate the probability of living or dying. The only question is whether what you are doing is just or unjust, appropriate for a good person or a bad one. According to your view, the heroes who fell at Troy were not worth much. Achilles, the son of Thetis, feared danger much less than disgrace. When his mother, the goddess, observed his eagerness to kill Hector, she said that if he avenged the death of his companion Patroclus, he would die himself. Fate, she said, waits upon you next after Hector. Upon hearing this, he utterly despised danger and death. Instead of fearing them, he feared to live in dishonor and not avenge his friend. Let me die next, he replied, and be avenged of my enemy, rather than abide here by the beaked ships, a scorn and a burden to the earth. Did Achilles have any thought of death and danger? Wherever a man's place is, whether one he has chosen or one in which he has been placed by a commander, there he ought to remain in the hour of danger. He should not think of death, but of disgrace. This, Athenians, is a true saying. Men of Athens, it would be strange indeed if I, who, when ordered by the generals you chose to command me at Potidaea and Amphipolis and Delium, remained where they placed me like any other man facing death, would now, when under orders from the god to fulfill the philosopher's mission of searching into myself and other people, desert my post through the fear of death or any other fear. That would be quite strange. And I might justly be arraigned in court for denying the existence of the gods and disobeying the oracle because I was afraid of death. In that case, I would pretend that I was wise when I was not wise, because such fear is the pretense of wisdom. It is not real wisdom, but rather the appearance of knowing the unknown. For no one knows whether death, which fear makes them think is the greatest evil, may not be the greatest good. Is not such pretense to knowledge really a disgraceful sort of ignorance? Here is where I think I am superior to other people, and where I might properly think that I am wiser. I know little about what comes after death, but I do not pretend to know more. But I do know that injustice and disobedience to someone better, whether God or human, is wrong and dishonorable. I will never fear or avoid a possible good, but I will always avoid a definite evil. Let's assume that you let me go free, rejecting the advice of Anitus, who said that if I were not put to death, I ought not to have been prosecuted, and that if I escape now, your sons will all be utterly ruined by listening to my words. Let's assume that you say to me, Socrates, this time we will ignore Anitus and will let you off, but only on the condition that you are not to inquire and speculate in this way any more, and that if you are caught doing this, you will die. If this were the condition on which you let me go, I would reply as follows. Athenians, I honor and love you, but I will obey the god rather than you. While I have life and strength, I will never stop practicing and teaching philosophy. I will exhort anyone whom I meet and try to convince that person, saying, my friend, why do you, a citizen of the great and mighty and wise city of Athens, care so much about acquiring the largest amount of money and honor and reputation and so little about wisdom, truth, and improvement of the soul, which you never think about at all? Are you not ashamed of this? If the person with whom I'm talking says, yes, I do care, I will not go away or release that person. I will interrogate and examine and cross-examine. If I think that person has no virtue but only pretends to have it, I will accuse that person of undervaluing the greater and overvaluing the less. I will say this to everyone whom I meet, young and old, citizen and foreigner, but especially to the citizens, because they are my siblings. This is the command from the god. I believe that no greater good has ever happened in the state than my service to the god. I do nothing but go around persuading you all, old and young alike, not to care primarily about your body or your property, but first and foremost to care for the improvement of the soul. I tell you that virtue does not come from money, but that from virtue come money and every other good for human beings, public as well as private. This is what I say, and if this is the doctrine that corrupts young people, my influence is truly destructive. But if anyone claims that this is not what I say, that person is not telling the truth. Men of Athens, I say to you, whether you do what Anitus suggests or not, whether you acquit me or not, please be aware that I will never change my ways, not even if I have to die many times. Athenians, do not interrupt me, but hear me out. We agreed that you would hear me out. I think that what I'm going to say will do you good. I have more to say, and you may be inclined to protest, but I beg you not to do so. I want you to know that if you kill someone like me, you will injure yourself more than you injure me. Miletus and Anitus will not injure me. They cannot do so, because it is not in the nature of things that a bad person should injure someone better. I don't deny that a person can be killed, or driven into exile, or deprived of civil rights. People may think that they are causing great injury, but I do not agree. The harm in doing what Anitus is doing, unjustly taking away another person's life, is far. Because you will not easily find another like me, I advise you to spare me. I'm sure that you feel irritated by being awakened suddenly when you are caught napping. You may think that if you were to strike me dead, as Anitus advises, which you can easily do, then you can go back to sleep for the rest of your lives, unless the god in his care send you another gadfly. I can prove to you that I was sent by the god. If I had been like other people, I would not have neglected my own affairs and been doing yours, coming to you individually like a father or elder brother, exhorting you to pay attention to virtue. It is not in human nature to do that. If I had gained anything, or if my exhortations had yielded a profit, there would have been some sense in what I was doing. But not even the impudence of my accusers goes so far as to say that I have ever asked for or received pay from anyone. I have a witness for the truth of what I am saying. My poverty. Someone may ask why I go around as a private citizen giving advice and occupying myself with other people's concerns, but do not venture into public life and advise the state. I'll tell you why. You have often heard me speak of a divine sign that comes to me, the divinity that Meletus ridicules in his indictment of me. I have had this sign ever since I was a child. It's like a voice that always forbids me to do something that I intend to do, but it never commands me to do something. This is what stands in the way of my being a politician. I think it's a good arrangement. Athenians, I'm sure that if I had engaged in politics, I would have died long ago and done no good either for myself or for you. Please don't be offended by my telling the truth. No person will survive who goes to war with you or any other majority, even if that person honestly opposes injustice in the state. A person who will fight for what is right and just, even for a short time, must have a private station and not a public one. I have evidence for this claim, not just words, but deeds which you value more than words. I'll tell you about my own life to show that I do not yield to injustice from fear of death. This is a commonplace story, but it's true. The only office I ever held in the state was that of senator. My tribe, Antiochus, held the presidency at the trial of the generals who failed to gather up the bodies of the men who were killed in the Battle of Arginusae. You proposed to try them all together, which was illegal, as you later realized. At that time, I was the only member of the executive committee who opposed the illegality, and I voted against it. When the orators threatened to impeach and arrest me and have me taken away, you urged them on with your shouts. I decided that I would run the risk of prison and death with law and justice on my side rather than take part in your injustice. This happened in the days of democracy. When the oligarchy of the 30 was in power, they summoned me and four others to the rotunda and ordered us to bring Leon of Salamis for execution. This is an example of the kind of commands they frequently gave to implicate as many people as possible in their crimes. I showed, not only in words, but through action, that I feared not death, but injustice and unholiness. Their power did not frighten me into doing what was wrong. When we came out of the rotunda, the other four went to Salamis to get Leon, but I went home. I would probably have been killed if the 30 had not lost power. Many of you were witnesses to this event. Do you think that I could have survived all these years if I had led a public life and also done what is right, making justice my first priority? There is no way, Athenians, that I or anyone else could do that. But I have been constant in my actions, public as well as private, never joining others in injustice, including those who are falsely said to be my students. Truth is that I have no students. Anyone, whether young or old, who wishes to listen to me while I carry out my service to the god is welcome to do so. I do not limit my conversation to those who pay. Anyone, rich or poor, may ask and answer and listen to my words. Whether that person turns out to be bad or good, I am not responsible because I never taught anyone. Whoever claims to have learned from me in private is not telling the truth. Whatever I say is open to the whole world. You may wonder why people delight in conversing with me. Men of Athens, I have already told you the whole truth about this. They find it amusing to hear me cross-examine those who pretend to be wise. The god has imposed this duty on me, as I am assured through oracles, dreams, and in every way that a divine command is ever revealed to anyone. Athenians, if this is not true, it can easily be refuted. If I am corrupting young people and have already corrupted some, the ones who have grown up and become aware that I have led them astray in their youth should come forward, accuse me, and take their revenge. If they do not want to come themselves, some of their kin, fathers, brothers, or other relatives should say what evil they have suffered at my hands. This is their chance. I see many of them here in court. There is Crito, who is my age and from the same deme. I also see his son Critobulus. Over there is Lucanius of Sphetus, the father of Aeschines, who is also here. Also present is Antiphon of Cephisus, who is the father of Epigenes, along with the brothers of several who have associated with me. There is Nicostratus, the son of Theosatides, and the brother of Theodotus. Theodotus himself is dead, so he will not try to stop him. There is Parolos, son of Demodocus, who is the brother of Theages. I also see Adamantus, the son of Ariston, whose brother Plato is present, and Iontodorus, the brother of Apollodorus. I could mention many others, any of whom Meletus could have called as witnesses when he spoke. Let him still call them if he forgot to do so. No Athenians, the exact opposite is true. All of these people are ready to testify on behalf of the corrupter, of the destroyer of their kindred, as Meletus and Anytus call me. That includes the corrupted youth who might be tainted. But why would their uncorrupted older relatives also want to support me with their testimony? Why indeed, except for the sake of truth and justice, and because they know that I am telling the truth and that Meletus is lying? Well, Athenians, this is all the defense I have to offer. But one more word. Perhaps someone will be offended upon recalling how you, on a similar or even less serious occasion, resorted to prayers and supplications filled with tears. Perhaps to arouse pity you brought your children to court, along with a horde of friends and relatives. Although I'm probably facing death, I will do none of these things. Perhaps this will come to mind and cause you to vote against me out of anger. If there is such a person, though I do not say there is, here is my reply. My friend, I am a man made of flesh and blood, not of oak or stone, as Homer says. I have a family, and yes, three sons, one of them almost grown up, and the other two still young. Yet I will not bring any of them here in order to beg you for acquittal. Why not? It is not from stubbornness or lack of respect for you. Whether I am or am not afraid of death is another question. My reason is simply that I believe such conduct would dishonor you, me, and the whole state. A person who has reached my age and who is considered to be wise, whether that reputation is deserved or not, ought not to act in such a way. The world has decided that Socrates is somehow superior to other people. Anyone considered to be superior in wisdom, courage, or any other virtue would be dishonored by such actions. I have seen people with good reputations, when they are condemned, acting in the strangest manner. They seem to imagine that they were going to suffer something dreadful if they died, and that they would be immortal if only you would let them live. I think they were a dishonor to the state. Any stranger coming into the city would say of them that the most eminent men of Athens, to whom the Athenians themselves give honor and high office, are no more than cowards. Such things ought not to be done by people with good reputation. If they are done, you ought not to encourage them, but should show that you are more inclined to condemn the person who puts on such a pathetic scene and makes the city look ridiculous. Putting aside the question of dishonor, there seems to be something wrong with begging for acquittal rather than informing and convincing the judge. The judge's duty is not to make a present of justice, but to make a judgment. The judge has sworn to judge according to the laws, not according to what is pleasing. None of us should get into the habit of perjuring ourselves. There is nothing holy about that. Please don't require me to do what I consider to be dishonorable and unholy and wrong, especially now when I am being tried for unholiness because of the indictment presented by Meletus. Athenians, if through the power of persuasion and supplication I could overcome your oath of office, then I would be teaching you that there are no gods. In that way I would convict myself in my own defense of not believing in them. But that is not the case, because I do believe that there are gods, in a far higher sense than that in which any of my accusers believe in them. To you and to the God, I commit my cause to determine what is best for you and for me. Men of Athens, for many reasons I do not grieve over your vote to convict me. I expected it, and I am only surprised that the vote was so close. I thought that the majority against me would have been far larger. If 30 votes had gone over to the other side, I would have been acquitted. I can say that I got the best of Miletus, because without the assistance of Anytus and Lycon, he would not have received 1/5 of the votes, as the law requires, and he would have had to pay a fine of 1,000 drachmae. He proposes death as the penalty. What shall I propose in response? I should propose what I deserve. What should I pay or receive? What should be done to the man who never had sense enough to be idle during his whole life, who has been careless concerning what most people care about, wealth, family, military and civic offices, speaking in the assembly, secret plots and political parties? Realizing that I am too honest to live that way, I avoided going where I could do no good to you or to myself. I went instead to where I could do the greatest good privately to every one of you, seeking to persuade each of you to seek virtue and wisdom before personal gain, and to consider the state as a whole before considering its narrow interests, proposing that this is the order we should follow in all our actions. What should be done to such a person? Men of Athens, no doubt it should be something good if I am to get what I deserve, something appropriate. What reward is suitable for a poor man who is your benefactor, one who needs free time to question you? I can think of no better reward, Athenians, than free meals in the Prytaneum, a reward he deserves far more than someone who has won a prize at Olympia in the horse or chariot race, whether the chariots were pulled by 2 horses or several. I am in need. That person has enough. Such people give you the appearance of happiness, whereas I give you the reality. If I am to judge the penalty, I say that free meals in the Prytaneum is my just reward. Perhaps you think I'm being insolent in saying this, as in what I said before about tears and prayers, but that's not the case. I say it because I'm convinced that I never intentionally wronged anyone, even though I haven't convinced you of that. We have had only a short conversation, but if there were a law in Athens, as there is in other cities, that a capital case should not be decided in a single day, then I think I would have persuaded you. There was too little time for me to refute such great slanders. Because I'm convinced that I've done nothing wrong, I do not intend to wrong myself. I will not tell you that I deserve any evil or propose any penalty. Why should I, from the fear of the death penalty that Miletus proposes? Because I don't know whether death is good or bad, why should I propose another penalty that would clearly be bad? Shall I propose imprisonment? But why should I live in prison and be the slave of the 11 magistrates appointed for the year? Or should the penalty be a fine and imprisonment until the fine is paid? I have the same objection because I have no money with which to pay the fine. Perhaps I should suggest exile. But if I were to do so, I would be blinded by the love of life. How could I consider that when even you, my fellow citizens, cannot stand my questions and conversations? If you have found them so objectionable that you wish to silence me, would other people tolerate me? No, Athenians, that's not likely. Besides, what kind of life would I lead at my age, wandering from city to city, living in exile and always being driven out? I'm confident that wherever I go, there is here, the young people will flock around me. If I send them away, their parents will drive me out at their request. If I let them stay, their fathers and friends will drive me out to protect them. Someone might say, Socrates, can't you hold your tongue? Then you might go to a foreign city and live in peace. I have great difficulty in making you understand my answer. If I tell you that I cannot hold my tongue because to do so would disobey a divine command, you won't believe that I'm serious. If I say that the unexamined life is not worth living, and that the greatest good for a human being is daily to converse about virtue and all the other topics about which you hear me examining myself and others, you are even less likely to believe me. Yet, what I say is true. Even if it is hard to persuade you, I am not used to thinking that I deserve any punishment. If I had any money, I would propose to give you what I have and would be no worse off. Because I have none, I can only ask that you adjust the fine to my resources. I think I could afford a mina, so I propose that penalty. My friends Plato, Crito, Critobulus, and Apollodorus are urging me to say 30 minae. Let that be the penalty. They will guarantee that amount. So you have voted to condemn me to death. Men of Athens, you won't gain much time in return for the bad name you will get from those who wish to malign the city. They will say that you killed Socrates, a wise man. For they will call me wise when they want to reproach you, even though I am not wise. If you had waited a little while, your desire would have been fulfilled in the course of nature. I am well advanced in years, as you can see, and not far from death. I'm speaking now only to those who condemned me to death. I have something else to say. You think that I was convicted through a lack of words. I mean, you think that if I had left nothing undone, nothing unsaid, I might have been acquitted. That's not so. The deficiency that led to my conviction was certainly not one of words. Rather, I did not have the boldness, the impudence, or the inclination to address you as you would have liked. Weeping and wailing and lamenting, saying and doing the kind of things you customarily hear from others. Those things, as I said, are unworthy of me. I thought I should avoid doing anything crude or servile in a time of danger. I do not regret the way I defended myself. I would rather die having spoken in my way than speak your way and live. Escaping death by any possible means is no more appropriate in court than in war. Often in battle, if you throw away your weapons and fall on your knees in front of the enemy, you may escape death. In facing other dangers, there are other ways to escape death, if you are prepared to do or say anything. The difficulty is not in escaping death, but in escaping wickedness, for that runs faster than death. I am old and move slowly. The slower runner has caught me. My accusers are keen and quick, and the faster runner, wickedness, has overtaken them. I now depart, condemned by you to suffer the penalty of death, and they also go their way, condemned by the truth to suffer the penalty of doing wrong. I must abide by my sentence, and they by theirs. I suppose things had to turn out as they did, and that is as it should be. Now, to you who have condemned me, I offer this prophecy. For I am about to die, and that is when we are endowed with prophetic power. Immediately after my death, you will receive punishment far greater than you have inflicted upon me. You kill me because you want to escape the accuser and avoid accounting for your lives. But things will not be as you expect. Far from it. There will be more accusers than there are now. The ones I have restrained, because they are younger, they will be more severe with you, and they will offend you more. If you think that by killing people you can avoid facing those who would censure your lives, you are mistaken. That way of escape is neither possible nor honorable. The easiest and best way is not to crush others, but to improve yourselves. This is the prophecy I offer to the judges who have condemned me. To those who voted to acquit me, I would also like to talk with you about what has happened while the magistrates are busy and before I go to the place where I must die. Stay for a while so that we may talk while there is still time. You are my friends, and I would like to explain the meaning of what has taken place. My judges, you I may truly call my judges, I want to tell you about something wonderful. Always in the past, if I was going to make a mistake about anything, the oracle within me was in the habit of opposing me even about the smallest matters. Now one would think that the last and worst evil has come to me. But the oracle made no sign of opposition, either as I was leaving the house and going out this morning, or when I entered the court, or while I was speaking. I have often been stopped in the middle of a speech, but in nothing I said or did here has the oracle opposed me. How do I explain this? I'll tell you. I consider this to be a proof that what has happened to me is something good. Those who think that death is something bad are mistaken. This is an important proof for me of what I'm saying, because the customary sign would surely have opposed me had I been going toward evil and not toward good. Let's look at it another way, and we'll see that there is reason to hope that death is something good. There are two possibilities. Either death is a state of nothingness and utter unconsciousness, or, as some people say, a change and a migration of the soul from this world to another. Let's suppose that there is no consciousness but only sleep, like the sleep of one who is undisturbed even by dreams. In that case, death is an incredible gain. If you were to select the night in which your sleep was dreamless, compare it with the other days and nights of your life, and then tell us how many days and nights you had passed better or more pleasantly than that one, I think you or any other person, including the great king, would not find many such days and nights when compared with the others. If death is like this, I say that to die is a gain, because then eternity is only like a single night. But if death is the journey to another place, and all the dead are there, as people say, what good can be greater than that? If when the traveler leaves behind those who pretend to dispense justice in this world and arrives in the other world to find the true judges awaiting there, Minos and Rhadamanthus and Aeacus and Triptolemus and all the other divine beings who lived good lives, that trip would be worth making. What would you not give to talk with Orpheus and Musaeus and Hesiod and Homer? If this be true, let me die again and again. I would have great interest in a place where I can converse with Palamedes, Ajax, son of Telamon, and other ancient heroes who have been put to death by an unjust judgment. There will be no small pleasure in comparing my experiences with theirs. Above all, I will be able to continue there, as here, to inquire about truth and falsehood. I'll be able to find out who is really wise and who pretends to be wise but is not. What would you give my judges to be able to examine the leader of the great Trojan expedition, Odysseus or Sisyphus or any number of other men and women? What infinite delight there would be in talking with them and asking them questions. In that world, they certainly don't put a person to death for asking questions if what is said is true, in addition to being happier in that world. We will be immortal. Therefore, judges, be cheerful about death. Know this to be true. Nothing evil can happen to a good person either in life or after death. Such people are not neglected by the gods. My own approaching end did not happen by chance. I see clearly that to die and be released is better for me, and so my oracle gave no sign. For that reason I am not angry with those who accused or condemned me. They have done me no harm, though neither group intended to do me any good. For this I may gently blame them. I have one favor to ask. When my sons are grown up, I would ask you, my friends, to punish them. I ask you to trouble them as I have troubled you. If they seem to care about wealth or anything else more than virtue, or if they pretend to be something when they are really nothing, then scold them as I have scolded you for not caring about that for which they ought to care and think that they are something when they are really nothing. If you do this, my sons and I will have received justice from your hands. The hour of departure has arrived, and we go our different ways. I to die, and you to live. Which is better, only the God knows.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.